Before I introduce the panel, I just wanted to circle back and make sure that we all understood what the nature of this medicine that was used in this study. So it's psilocybin. This is a substance found in numerous mushroom species around the world. There's evidence that it's been used for hundreds of years, if not millennia, by native peoples in Mexico in particular. The Mazatec people used these mushrooms for essentially shamanic spiritual purposes. The mushrooms and the psilocybin in the mushrooms produce an altered state of consciousness that is kind of characterized by altered sensory perception, different perception of colors. All the senses are changed. In fact, sometimes a stimulus in one sensory modality will be perceived or interpreted in another. So people report seeing sounds or seeing the music, etc. There are also changes in ego boundaries. People can feel that they're part of a greater whole, being connected to the universe. Sometimes people report what could be called things like paranormal phenomena, being able to read others' thoughts or having their thoughts being read, or ideas of precognition, believing that they can perhaps see the future, changes in time and space, and all sorts of changes, and in fact, feelings of awe and wonder. And this probably underlies the use of these substances for spiritual purposes. The psilocybin experience lasts in a neighborhood of 4 to 6 hours. Some of the other medicines that Dr. Muller mentioned, such as LSD, last maybe 8 to 10 hours, so psilocybin is rather shorter lived. And it's really one of the so-called classic hallucinogens or classic psychedelics, which includes mescaline, LSD, DMT, and psilocybin, again, a natural product. So with that, I think what I'd like to do is introduce the study team, just give you a bit of background. These are the volunteers, the people who underwent this escalating dose of psilocybin. So they, this was entirely voluntary, but they could take up to 3 doses that were higher and higher. So the first dose was a 0.3 milligram per kilo dose, and then there was a 0.45, and then a 0.6 milligram per kilo. So it's approximately 20, 30, and 40 milligrams. But it's based on body weight, and one of the volunteers, I believe, had a 60 milligram dose of psilocybin. And so it's the mushrooms contain approximately, if I recall, something like 0.6% by weight of wet weight and 6% by dry weight. So the 20 milligram dose of psilocybin is approximately equivalent to perhaps 3 grams of dried mushrooms. The 30 would be, maybe 4.5 to 5. And then when you go up to 60 milligrams, as the one volunteer took it, this is, in the neighborhood of probably, 9 or 10 grams of dried mushrooms. Kind of hard to fathom that amount. So we have 3 of the volunteers here, and the first person is Jeff Gilpin, who will be kind of moderating the discussion group. He's a Madison-based author of literary nonfiction, was a master of fine arts from Goucher College. His memoir, The Maharishi Effect, A Personal Journey Through the Movement That Transformed American Spirituality, his experiences with transcendental meditation, was published by Tarcher Penguin. His current project is a book about psychedelic research. He's also quite adept as a software designer and writer. Diane Pasley is Vice President Loan Officer for a nonprofit economic development finance company in Madison. where she has worked for the past 19 years. Diane obtained a degree in finance and an MBA from colleges in Ohio. She had very little experience with psychedelics prior to 2014, when she attended an ayahuasca ceremony in Peru. Diane credits that trip as the most impactful, life-changing experience, with the participation in the UW study a very close second. She loves adventure, both inside and out, as she is a licensed pilot, scuba diver, has 47 skydives, and loves to travel. She has two teenage sons and a Siamese cat. What's the cat's name?
Simon.
Simon the Siamese, okay. And finally, Mazda Bradbury is an MD PhD student in the UW Medical Scientist Training Program. Currently in his third year of medical school, he will begin a PhD studying cellular and molecular neurophysiology this fall. And last year, he was in my pharmacology course, so we got to know each other a little bit before this study took place. Originally from New Haven, Connecticut, by way of Pittsburgh and Evanston, his other interests include music, modernity, and the construction of conscious experience. So please welcome our three panel members. We're going to sit here and have discussion, and we would encourage any questions you might have, any responses to their discussion, and kind of produce like a dialogue here. A conversation.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you all very much for joining us today. We are three of the 12 volunteer participants in the UW School of Pharmacy study on the effects of psilocybin. 12 of us came from a broad variety of backgrounds, and I'm pleased to say that we have both the youngest and oldest participants in the study on our panel today. Maz is 25, and I am 62. And all of us had to go through an extensive screening process to qualify for the study, and all of us had a wide variety of experiences during the study sessions. So to start off, I'd like to point out that one of the qualifications for the study was a previous and recent positive experience with psychedelics, which all of us had in one way or the other, but that's obviously very different from a research study. So I'd like to start by asking the panel members, what were the biggest differences between your previous work with psychedelics and your experiences in the study?
Okay. Well, like you had said in the introduction, I have had a lot of experience, so I did have a retreat ceremony in Peru, which was amazing, but that was, there were a lot of people there per se, so I think the number one thing was this was so individual. It was totally focused on you, and having the counseling before and the guides during was just incredible. And Dan and Karen, I couldn't have asked for anybody better, so it was just so individual and just so... It's such a gift.
I think this one's on now. So I should probably, because I'm a medical student, clarify that my views do not represent those of the School of Medicine or Public Health, and also do not represent any medical opinion whatsoever. There's merely my own. I think, like Diane just said, one of the most unique things about this, sort of relative to the experiences that most people associate with psychedelic drugs, is how inwardly focused it is meant to be and really benefits from you. You are encouraged to, as you feel the effects of the psilocybin, lie down with eye shades on and even wear headphones. Not a typical experience with psychedelics for many people. MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, that's not the setting in which they usually take it. I think also what was unique about this, as Diane said, was that it was sort of in the milieu, it's never the medicine itself. It is the medicine in the context of outstanding guidance that is full of wisdom. You know, so much, I look at what I take away from this, and so much of this, I can't parse out whether it was just the psilocybin or just the preparatory sessions with Dan and Karen. There's so much in both of those, and because we're talking about the drugs, but I can't emphasize enough, like I said, how important and how much wisdom was contained in those initial sessions.
You mentioned second setting, and we talked a lot about that in the psychedelic community, and it's interesting that second setting really can determine the nature of your experience, your trip. And a person can take the same dose of the same substance under two different conditions and have completely different experiences. And of course, psychedelics are famous for providing a broad range of experiences. Some of us in the study described our experiences as heavenly, some as hellish. And I'd like to ask the panel members, what were your experiences during the sessions like? And do subjective experiences really make a difference?
Yes. you know, Dan used the word ineffable, which is the best word because it's an excuse and I really cannot put in words what just happened to me. And so, you know, on any given day, I might describe this any number of different ways, but what I like to, you sort of are experiencing, for me, it was a lot of sort of, part of it was mediated by what felt like re-experience, like a very vivid dream of something that may have happened in my life or may not have happened in my life, except I was having five of these dreams at once, and they were all enormously vivid and contained at that moment for me, what was the ultimate lesson? What did this mean for myself? How did this fit in to me as a person and the way I relate to the world and understand the world? So that was, but then you're like, you're all over the place. There's all kinds of emotion. As far as what is the actual context, like what are you visualizing? For people with different, coming from different backgrounds, it'll be different. You know, if you have to work through what was perhaps an incredibly traumatic event in your youth, that might comprise the bulk of your experience. I think that sort of experientially mediated part of this is why this works so well, but also why it's so mysterious and difficult to understand from the perspective of psychologists and psychiatrists. So, yes, they matter.
So the question was kind of explain the experience a little bit?
Yeah.
So,
and do subjective experiences matter?
Yeah. So one thing that Dan and Karen always said is you get what you need to see or hear or whatever. So I think a lot of the talking about it before, and I had no idea what to expect, and one of my friends that was in the study had some really hard experiences, and fortunately, I mean, all three of my experiences were pretty amazing. They all built on the other. The first one, So the first one was more of an observer and just kind of getting a feel, but the music, like I said, the music just talked to me. It gave me this lesson in jazz was incredibly beautiful. It just love and interconnectedness. And at one point I went into the bathroom and I was looking in the mirror and there were a couple goals that I had, and one was to get wiser, to be one of those wise women, and I looked like this 70-year-old lady. And after the study, when I went back, I'm like, oh, good, I'm young again. Because I thought it was real. So the first one, but then the second one built on it, where instead of like observing, I kind of more turned into it. And at one point, there was like a spinning wheel of life that I was telling them that I could just put my finger out, and I was this different place, this person. Then I could do it there, and I just understood just how we're all actually just different versions of each other, but we're all part of the same thing. And it was clear. And then the last session, which was the highest dose, I remember thinking it was just this incredible feeling of wholeness that you couldn't have gotten anywhere else. And, you know, personal, you know, things I was going through, I'm going through a divorce from a 20-year marriage, and just knowing, I was thinking that, you know, thinking of all the different people in my life, and I realized, will that person be there for me? You know, no, they can't. They've got their own life. But it wasn't a sad feeling. It was just this understanding that, you know, we're we interact with each other, but you don't need, I mean, you need each other, but I'm whole with who I am. And that feeling and knowing is such an incredible gift from the study and getting to hear it, so. Anyway, and I can't believe they paid me to do it.
Diane mentioned that her experiences changed a bit during the different sessions. Nick said, as Nick said, we had three increasing doses of psilocybin culminating in 40 milligrams per 70 kilograms of body weight, which I think is maybe the largest dose of psilocybin that's been used in a research study so far. It usually tops out at about 20 or 30 milligrams. And I'm wondering if you two noticed a qualitative difference as the doses got larger, and also do you feel that the overall experience of having three increasing doses was significant to your experience at all?
There was not a clear any sort of linearity to the doses, any particular aspect of the effect that was increasing in magnitude with each dose. My second dose, the middle one, was sort of the weakest, and I felt most attenuated and kind of lamest of all of them. Not that any of them were lame, but I felt like I wasn't really getting where I needed to be. And incidentally, before this dose, I had just taken an exam the day before. I was sleep deprived and like promptly passed out after I had gone back to the hospital. We were admitted to the hospital overnight because they're 18 and 24 hour time points, which you can't, happens at 2 in the morning. And I was zonked. And then for the third dose, I had come back after like a few weeks off of school, just studying, whatever. And this was a powerful, and what I noticed more than any subjective effect was actually the duration. So like at the end of 8 hours, I was like, oh, it's time to go. Like, this is great. So for me, not particularly subjective effects, but I think it really highlighted for me the importance of, it's again set in setting, but just sort of my health and well-being going into it. I didn't feel particularly down, but I was just exhausted, and that apparently very clearly modulated the effect of the dose in a very important way.
I felt like they built on each other to some degree.
I think the first one maybe was the hardest, just because I didn't know what to expect, and it seemed more physically challenging. And you would think that the last one would have been because it was. But maybe I just got more used to it. But I think if I would have stopped after the first, it would have been great. But I mean, lessons of the three combined was, I think, great. So I'd do a fourth.
Well, the third big dose was humongous. The experience was quite different from the first two. And I thought that after the first and second one, I really thought I've got the psychedelic stuff psyched up. And I know what's going on. And I was not prepared for the third session in which I no longer existed. I wasn't in the room anymore. I didn't know if I'd die, if my ego had dissolved for good. And I came back, I managed to crawl back into my ego, into a universe that was total chaotic stuff flying around. And Karen said to me, "You're doing good work." And at that point, I knew it was going to be okay. And I knew that even though I couldn't trust myself because I didn't know if I was even alive or not, I knew that I could trust Karen and Dan. And I'm not a trusting person. And I finally learned how to trust. And that was the biggest thing. Next question. Has your life been different since your last session? And if so,
it has been a lot more, it's been changed forever. I think you don't take stuff as seriously as you used to. You realize how silly some of the stuff is that we worry about. you know, as Dan would say at some point, this like human reality is just such a small sliver of the bigger whole. And you know, what really matters, you know, that material stuff. And it's so funny with my industry being in finance and the materialistic, very greedy world. So, I mean, but still, I think you need people to learn in every industry. Everybody is where they're at, so no judgment to where you've been or where you're going. But just, yeah. I already was excited about life, but, you know, even more so.
So, why am I so loud? So, I think for me, the way my life changed the most, I think I gained a measure of acceptance and a measure of, I think, willingness to touch in with acceptance, especially with regard to myself and what I think about myself and the characteristics of my personality, how I relate to other people. And again, I'll highlight here that this part of this is probably the psilocybin, but a huge part of this is the wisdom that I was so lucky to gain talking to Dan and Karen for our prep sessions. I am very much was born and have always been a very sort of cerebral person. I think my way through stuff because that's just the way I learned to live my life. And what I got out of this whole thing was a really newfound sensation for my body. And what my body can tell me with regard to how I'm relating with other people, how they're relating to me, and moreover, how I can use my body and the sensations in my body to assert an interaction with other people. And the way that this has benefited me most, you know, as a medical student, you walk into, as in your third year, you walk into people's rooms. You just kind of play the role of like pretend doctor. You're learning to be a doctor, so you do have some unsupervised time with patients. I'm oftentimes the first one seeing this patient. And you don't know what to expect, and they actually might be quite hostile and often are quite anxious about the situation at hand, obviously with good reason. And what I learned to do sort of as a result, or because of this, my experience here, was to let my body not only guide me through the situation, feel things out, but also to assert a sense of comfort and of acceptance in the environment. And the way I describe this is it's like going and giving someone a hug without giving them a hug. I just kind of focus on my body and feel myself going out and giving the other people in the room a big hug. And you feel that, right? And it's awesome. And it's like, this is like a practical benefit of doing this whole, and again, I don't know how much of this is the psilocybin, how much of this is techniques that Dan and Karen taught me, which were incredible. But it's amazing. And that sense of my body and how I relate to my body and it influences, and I go on and on about sort of the lower borders of consciousness, but that, in a nutshell, is a big part of it.
This study changed everything for me. It's like going through a door. You can't go back the other way, but it's a completely different life. A strength, a sense of peace, a sense of perspective that made it possible for me to survive what turned out to be the hardest year of my life. My mom is in hospice right now. She has Alzheimer's. We had one series of family health crises after another, and I was able to navigate that okay, thanks to what I gained during the study. So these sessions can have very real, immediate, practical benefits. How are we doing for time? Okay, let's keep going. There's a growing amount of research that shows that psychedelics can have positive benefits for people suffering from serious medical conditions such as depression, addiction, PTSD. Do you think that psychedelics can have positive benefits for healthy people? And if so, what do those benefits
mean? No way.
So I've got two sons, 16 and 82, and I have to figure out, but I just think if you want to learn these lessons through age, well, I do get it, or even people in the business community, Yes, I think it's too bad you have to be terminally ill to get in on these studies. Actually, we were fortunate in a healthy adult study, which is very rare, so I don't see how it could hurt. In the right set and setting. I mean, that was key, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. And Diana, she just pointed that out. You know, there are certain, as these studies are being done, there are certain contraindications to using these studies in research. Patients with any history of psychotic disease, I don't know how deep in the family has to go. Patients with issues with hemodynamic stability, maybe elevated blood pressure. I don't know exactly what it is, but there are certain, this is not sort of, you know, anybody can go and take and use psilocybin, even in the right sentence setting, and be okay. Like, these are being done very carefully. In part because we tried this 50 years ago, and it didn't work. People got too excited about it. You know, we can sit up here and, you know, get and, you know, get all tickled about it. But the thing is that this is something that's very sensitive, not only sort of socially but also medically. There are huge, even though the preliminary data look excellent in these studies, there are still significant concerns with the safety of these diseases. You know, that the story of, you know, cousin Jimmy, who took acid and went off the deep end, and no one's heard from him in 30 years, and he's probably in, you know, Peru somewhere. That is the reality that many people know for these compounds, because that's what they were taught, and they haven't really had any experience that suggests otherwise. With that being said, a word to why these might work so well. I think, you know, my own experience with this is that a lot of psychiatric illness, and again, keep in mind that the way we categorize psychiatric illness, the way we think about it, is quite flawed, and there are efforts at the NIH to really change that. I suggest any of you who are interested in this to look at the RDoC criteria. There's sort of like a long-term effort to change the way that we think about what is psychopathology. But a lot of that, it subjectively tends to revolve around sort of ruminative processes, this sort of getting caught up in sort of repetitive thought habits that often are self-destructive. And what these compounds allow us to do, MDMA, psilocybin, the other classical psychedelics, that is a little bit more difficult with alcohol and cannabis, is they allow us to break the cycle. They allow you even just a few hours of time outside this little mouse wheel that you call yourself. And for many people, that can be extraordinarily valuable. Extraordinarily valuable.
As Maz said, psychedelic research is still unfamiliar to a lot of people. It's a very sensitive stage of the work now. There's still a lot of misunderstanding held over from the 60s and from the war on drugs. And as study volunteers, you have a unique experience and a unique perspective to share. Especially, you have a unique role to play in communicating with people in the public who might be hesitant about supporting psychedelic research or possibly participating in psychedelic therapy themselves. If you could speak to the public about this issue, what would you say?
So, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. You know, people fall into different camps, and unfortunately, sometimes when you're trying to tell someone about how valuable this is, you kind of feel like you're like a Jehovah's Witness knocking on someone's door and trying to convince them of the value of their, you know, their God and their faith and all of that. I think the first thing to understand is that the insights that are often gained in experiences occasioned by psychedelic drugs are most often totally compatible with rational philosophical relationships with the world. There's not a lot, you know, that there really is nothing that I experienced as a result of this, and I've gained as a result of this study, that is fantastical or far-fetched. It really is just a clarification rather than a sort of unnatural extension of ordinary consciousness. And the second is honestly, go to people who are in science, do a PubMed search on psilocybin, see what comes up, and spend a week reading it, and come back and talk. There are not only these sort of new clinical trials that are being done, but you study this stuff on a public health level. You look at the National Survey on Drug Use. I forget what the full exact name is, but it's some folks have done studies on this, and this is hundreds of thousands of individuals over the past 10 years, and they look at people who have used these compounds, And do they have recent or remote incidents of psychological distress, psychotic symptoms, suicidal ideation, symptoms of depression, anxiety, etc.? And none of this stuff, even the symptoms of psychosis, as I understand it, with psychedelic drug use alone, increase significantly. And in fact, if you control for use of other drugs, depending on how you control for use of other drugs, people who have used psilocybin are actually at a slightly lower risk of experiencing symptoms of psychological distress. The point being that the massive, you know, then, you know, you're kind of right around that like 1.0 relative risk. Like, it's not big either way. But the point is that these really horrible sort of, I guess, stimulations of a psychotic break, really, that you hear about, don't really happen. Same thing with this hallucinogen persisting perceptive disorder, HPPD. It's when you look at the data and you examine people in a non-biased way, or an ideally unbiased way, you can't have an unbiased study, that stuff all melts away. It's not really there. So just look at the data and spend some time with it, think about it, and come back, because a lot of the concerns about the safety and whatnot really do not hold up when these questions are examined in a rigorous fashion.
You know, I think one of the things is that there's a whole point of this is to get more awake and aware of just reality. So psychedelics aren't the only way, but I can say from being in the study, like when I meditate now, I know where to go. Where before, my mind was just going and it's so dark. I mean, I didn't, so maybe for me that was kind of like, just helped me, like, you know, shortcut to figure out some of this stuff. So, I mean,
I think we have a few minutes left for questions. Does anybody have any? Yes.
So you mentioned that one of the important factors for the experiences were the insights of your guides. It was mentioned that one of them at least had experience with LSD as a teenager. I have to question whether the wisdom came from the guide or his experience with the LSD. That drove him to this career choice to this day. I'd like him to speak on it if he's living.
Yeah, that's Dan.
Who knows? You know, you are who you are, you experience what you experience. I'd say what Diane said is this idea of getting a peek at the peak. So peak, P-E-K, at the peak, P-E-A-K, shows you where you want to go. So, you know, from drugs, I went into the martial arts and learned how to meditate. And so, you know, I've been meditating since 1976. So the idea of opening your mind and seeing what could be reality and then coming back down and doing a slower climb up the mountain over years and years, there's something to be said for that. And I've done yoga and all sorts of other things more recently in the past. At least 20 years ago, we started doing some shamanic journeying, which is very powerful stuff. So who knows? The only thing that I can say is that for me, in this body, in this brain, in this experience at age 16, was profound. And I had other bunch of LSD trips, none of which were as profound as this one, where basically I became every being on the planet. And that feeling of connectedness took me to a place where I was no longer this very angry teenager who really rejected, you know, this world that it can be an ugly looking world. but you can see below that and above that.
One thing that Dan taught me is that wisdom exists within us and without us. It can come from all over. It's what you do with it that counts in the end. And we went inside during the sessions to discover what wisdom we could find in there, but what we put into action out after the sessions is for the ultimate truth of life. Any other questions?
So you spoke about the relief of anxiety and feeling more centered, perhaps, and paraphrasing, relief of depression. We have tons of drugs that will relieve anxiety. We have tons of antidepressants. What makes these any better? Or why not just have a Xanax if you're feeling anxious?
So I think this is because it sort of helps reroute what your brain does with different stimuli, right? So you have, say, if we want to conceptualize this, we can have a box that says anxious state on it, and that's your mind when you're anxious. And you have all of these other boxes that represent all the other possible states of your mind at different places at different times that point to that, right? And what these drugs do is, rather than once you're in that anxious state, helping you sort of go drift out of that temporarily somewhere else, you could argue that what they do is they build in different habits of mind, conscious and unconscious, that help some of those arrows that lead from all of these other possibilities to this anxious state kind of go elsewhere. And they help you sort of, you could argue that you consciously or unconsciously rationalize your way out of the anxious state more easily. You know, I don't know, I don't have the background in functional neuroanatomy to explain to you which brain regions might be more or less dominant in a mind that has been sort of conditioned properly with psilocybin versus one that hasn't. But essentially, that's the idea, is that you have functional connectivity changes that result in it being less likely for you to enter a state of anxiety and for you to be more comfortable and spend more time in the box that says peace and acceptance on it.
Yeah, we have a lot to learn yet about how these things work. My subjective experience is that, unlike any other drug that I've used, psychedelics provide a sense of liberation. It really is like being freed from prison. You can get out and stretch and look around. And the incredible thing is that, for some reason, the sense of freedom and liberation lasts. It persists. And that's what I'm interested in. Maybe one more?
Yeah. How do you approach compassion and change in your life going forward?
What was the question?
Just one, I went out of time too. I mean, we're still human, obviously. So, but just trying to use what we learned
Tools and meditating a little bit more. So, and just, yeah, just knowing this person that you're mad at is really you, and what you're mad at is in you. So just the knowingness of bigger picture, I guess. Going off what Diane just said, you know, I think it's also important to add that moving forward, you know, you're in a good place maybe right after, or a few weeks after, a few months after you go through this therapeutic regime. But your brain remains plastic, and you can always slip back into a mindset, a way of living that's exactly the way you were before. You know, you may be in touch with certain aspects of wisdom, and I would argue that it's probably easier to get back to a place of peace and acceptance and general well-being. But this is stuff that requires maintenance. You know, part of it is, it's not just putting yourself in a better place, like being born again. Part of it is getting to a better place, but also learning how to stay there. So it requires ongoing effort on the part of the individual.
Okay, I do have one last question before you go. Before we go, this is really quick. I'd like to ask this of all of you. And I would like a show of hands, please. If this research study that we participated in were to be repeated again starting tomorrow, how many of you would consider volunteering? Thank you all.
Thank you. Hopefully, after the movie, you'll have another opportunity to have a question and answer again with the panel.